You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Hey there, boys and girls. Welcome to another edition of The Business of Sports with Andrew Brand. I'm your host, Andrew Brand. We try to make it a unique and differentiated podcast with my experience, my insights from many years as an agent, many years as a team executive, many years as a professor of sports business and sports law, and of course, my role in media as a business of sports analyst. All for you here to hear these quick, short, and information-filled insights for the next 25 to 30 minutes, as I do every week. I wanted to get you updated on a lot of issues this week in and around baseball with the Shohei Ohtani thing. We're going to talk about Jante Porter in the NBA. We're talking about NFL issues coming out of the owners' meetings. Lots to get to today. Just let you know that music you heard under us is my son, Sam Brandt. He's the musical producer. We're produced by Jack Connell, and we're presented, as always, by DraftKings, who will make an appearance in this podcast on a different level. Okay, let's get to it, and we'll start where we started last week, because this story, as I said last week, is not going to get lesser. It's going to get more. It's not going to go away, despite what they tried to do yesterday. Okay, let's review. Shohei Ohtani, the MVP, the owner of the largest team sports contract in the history of American sports, the MVP, the LA Dodgers, the two-way player who started his season last week in Korea, of all places, who plays for the most valuable franchise in Major League Baseball, the LA Dodgers. He held a press conference. It wasn't an interactive press conference. It was a one-way press conference where he, in his native language, Japanese, controlled the narrative and, I'm sure, advised by lawyers, attorneys, agents, etc., to do it that way. He had a new interpreter, and he said, basically, deny, deny, deny. I had no knowledge of this was happening. I never bet on baseball. I never bet on other sports. I never did any of this. Basically, throwing his once seemingly best friend, an interpreter, and confidant, and close ally that was always there until last week, Ipe, under the bus. Then backing up the bus, going over Ipe a few times, going forward, sideways, front, back, over Ipe with the bus. Okay, here is where we are. We have a complete denial. We have Ipe nowhere to be found. We have Major League Baseball saying they're doing an investigation. We have the FBI continuing an investigation into this illegal bookmaker in Southern California. And a couple others have turned up and turned state evidence against that bookie. And here's where we are. Now, it would seem to me that forensics and wire transfers and records would be out there to show if Shohei Ohtani made any of these wire transfers himself. That is probably not the case, but there are wire transfers from his account to the bookie, which doesn't look good. Now, he's going to say and has said it's all Ipe, and he had nothing to do with it. We'll see. I just hope that Major League Baseball takes this seriously, investigates seriously, and asks the questions to Ohtani that we wanted answered yesterday. We're not going to get answered from Ohtani because he's going to hide behind his lawyers now. But here are some of the questions that should have been asked. How did Ipe have access to your account? How did Ipe wire these large sums of money from your account to an illegal bookie without you knowing anything about it? How was Ipe so invested and involved in gambling, and you were so close to him and had no idea? Did Ipe ever ask you for advice on gambling, on baseball, or any other sport? who else had access to your accounts? Was it eBay? Was it your managers at CAA? Was it your attorneys? Was it your accountants? Was it your financial managers and your best friend? Was it your wife you just married? Who else had access to these accounts? And what bank allowed these massive amounts to be sent to an illegal bookie without any notification to you? And if there was notification, where did it go? Did it go to IPE? Did IPE have access to that as well? Did IPE hide this from you all along, even though you were so close? What is your relationship with IPE now? How did you feel about the Dodgers firing him? Are you in touch with him? What would you say to him if he reached out? And there should be phone records of any conversations after. Again, when this was all going on, we saw a video of Ohtani and IPE in the dugout laughing, having a nice tender moment. So many questions coming out of this. Okay, a lot of people ask me in these situations, if I was an agent like I was many years, how would I be handling this? Probably the way they handled it in terms of a statement and no questions. Because I think as an attorney, you don't even want to get near those questions. That's fine. But you went farther than you needed to here. If there is any semblance of being involved with gambling and wire transfers. Because Ohtani and his team decided we're going full, complete, 100% denial of everything. Now, what that means is you've opened yourself up for not necessarily being involved in gambling, not necessarily giving tips to IPE, not necessarily even knowing IPE was doing that, but having knowledge, if there's anything out there that said to Ohtani through IPE, through his agents, through his bank, through his attorneys, that this was happening, that's a problem. Now, again, he can hide behind language. He can hide behind, well, I trust people to do that for me. But that's fine when he's talking about petty cash. These are massive amounts of money. And as we know, his contract was structured. I know he makes a lot of endorsement money, but he doesn't make much money contractually because everything's deferred. So what is going on? I have more questions than answers. Now, listen, my Twitter feed is full of things like, hey, he's the fall guy. And that may have happened. I think, you know, when IPE went to ESPN and told this whole story, something's behind that. So again, I'm just putting on my thinking hat. This guy, IPE, got in too big with this bookie, got deep. It was a problem. Okay? He, again, just speculation. His buddy helped him out. And when they heard that the media was coming down the pike, he tried to get in front of it and say, yeah, my buddy helped me out, but had no knowledge, never bet on baseball, never did anything. And then it gets back to Ohtani's people like, we can't even have that. No, we can't have that. We can't have that he knew anything, that he helped him out. No. So that was pulled back. I worry. I say this partly in jest, partly seriously. I worry about IPE. Where is he? He's been summarily fired. Did they give him a payoff to not talk? Because he's obviously the key witness here. The key witness in any Major League Baseball investigation and the key witness in any FBI investigation. He knows what he did. He knows who was funding it. And obviously he got credit from this bookie for millions of dollars because of his relationship with Ohtani. Did he hide that completely from Ohtani? Come on. Okay, listen. What happens with these big investigations, if baseball has internal people doing it, but I would think they're going to outsource to some big law firm like the NFL does with all their big reports, like the NBA does with their big reports, and look into this. A lot of investigative work, a lot of interviews. The key interview, of course, is IPE, whose whereabouts are unknown. Ohtani will interview with exactly what he just did in this controlled press conference, say, I don't know, not involved. trust people to do it for me. Have no idea. Trusted Ipe. He burned me. He is the victim. That's what the lawyer said. Victim of massive theft. We assume by Ipe of $405 million that's gone to the bookies. It's not like Ipe's walking around with it. More questions than answers. This story's not going away as much as baseball wants it to. Of course, Ohtani will shut up now and just play ball, but this is not a good look for baseball, and it's not going away. It's not. Because, well, I'll save this after I talk about the NBA issue. Okay, the NBA is probably merrily rolling along saying, oh, but for the grace of God, there go we. You know, with baseball having these Ohtani gambling issues, Adam Silver and the NBA is rolling along mid-season, heading towards the playoffs, all going well. And then we get this story yesterday from Adrian Wojnarowski of ESPN. Oh my God, here we go again. Where's a player who I never heard of before yesterday named Jonte Porter with the Toronto Raptors. Jonte Porter is the subject of a Jonte Porter is the subject of a major investigation about his actions on court in two games, one in January, one last week in March. And there was heavy betting on under, and in those games, he leaves early with an injury or an illness or whatever it is, and it's flagged. And even DraftKings puts out their daily report and said something about, hey, big winner yesterday, Jonte Porter, someone named Jonte Porter, someone bet big on the under with him, and look, they won a lot of money. Okay, a couple things right away. Like, hello, whoever, and if it's Porter himself, of course, that's a bigger hello. Hello, do whoever make this bet, whether Porter himself or otherwise, did they not realize this would be a flag of a G League two-way player? Someone betting big on the under with him? Hello? Like, sometimes betting is one thing, but having some common sense and situational awareness is another. Are you kidding me? DraftKings, FanDuel, PrizePicks, all these people have mechanisms to flag bets that raise eyebrows. This is a guy who doesn't play. This is a guy who is a two-way player. I never heard of him. Average sports fan? You ever heard of this guy before yesterday? So right away, the NBA's got, okay, who is this? What are we going to do here? If it's limited to him and or his buddies, that's an easy call for the NBA. Drop him through a trap door. Get rid of him. Say it's a rogue player. He's out. We'll never hear from him again. Just like Ipe, gone. Just like they did to Tim Donaghy when they had a refereeing scandal years ago. They just said, we have a rogue official. They fired him, they got him out, and they moved on. This is what will happen to Jonte Porter, assuming there's no web of people beyond that. But this story just did the NBA a favor. While the Major League Baseball is wrestling with their best player and whether he was at all involved in his best friend incurring $4.5 million of gambling debts, the NBA got a layup. They get a nobody player who was flagged for these stupid under bets where he came out of the game for illness or injury, and they just suspend him forever. No one's going to miss him. Even their own team. He's a two-way player. So, contrast. Major League Baseball, that's not going to go away. That's a big-time player, big-time issue. If this was the NBA, a big-time player, we'd have a major story here that maybe would outshine this Ohtani story. But it's Jonte Porter. Boy, did the NBA, which I'm assuming is going to be a trapdoor, get him out of the league, suspend him for life, ban him. Unless there's more to it. Okay. Gambling in general. You know, we have been here before. Listen, The leagues, NBA, Major League Baseball, NFL, NHL, NCAA, all fought this in court for 7 years. As a sports lawyer, as a law professor, I taught this, I followed this, I covered this for ESPN, I sat in courtrooms. Integrity was the big issue, right? What is going to be the issue with integrity? And they fought it under the guise of integrity. They fought specifically the state of New Jersey, Chris Christie, trying to implement sports betting. You can't do that. There's this 1992 law in the books that doesn't allow that except for the grandfathered states like Nevada. Well, Supreme Court was not going to take the case, according to most experts, and they took it. And they argued it in December 17. I sat there in the Supreme Court, my first time ever there, sat, didn't see much because I sat behind the very large Chris Christie. And lo and behold, May 14th, 2018, they ruled for New Jersey against the leagues. Since that time, we now have 38 states with legalized gambling, although California in the Ohtani case is not one of those states. We have an acceptance of sports gambling that is beyond probably anyone ever thought. We have it embedded in our consciousness. We cannot watch sports or follow sports on media or social media or radio or podcasts like this one without being inundated by sports gambling. It's everywhere. So we understand sports gambling is in our face and embedded. But the league's position has been, well, first let's say this. The leagues who fought this in court for 7 years, it went the other way and now they've embraced it. They've embraced it with everything I'm talking about, with in-your-face sports betting everywhere, in their product, embedded in their broadcasts, embedded in their programming, embedded in social media, everywhere. We have Caesars, the official online casino of the NFL. We have all the things going on with the betting sites. And we have legality in 38 states. The other part of this is the leagues continue to restrict the player side. So it's do as I say, don't do as I do. Now, there are different rules in the NFL. You can certainly bet on anything besides football as long as you're away from the facility. Jameson Williams and the Detroit Lions was at the facility or sitting in the parking lot, so that became a problem. So we have all these different permutations in baseball. Ohtani, or if he did in fact bet on sports outside of baseball, he would have been fined if he did so legally, but in California, that wouldn't be legally. And we've seen situations where, yeah, it's Calvin Ridley. I mean, players have mixed messages because the leagues have embedded it. The leagues are embracing it, but they can't do it. But it's just the way it is, okay? So the leagues say, do as I say, don't do as I do. But at some point, it is understandable and expected and inevitable that we have these situations going on, right? And we have two big ones going on at the same time. Not necessarily equal types of players, but two big situations with baseball and Ohtani and with the NBA and Jonte Porter. This is inevitable. We are in, you know, it's May 2018. We're still under 6 years. Okay. So we're still figuring it out. Now in Europe, it's been everywhere. They've been betting on games at kiosks at soccer stadiums forever. I don't know what kind of scandals they have, but it's far advanced in terms of time compared to American sports. So I guess we're still getting used to it. Have we had more scandals than people know about? Perhaps. You know, I was in Vegas last week. It's, you know, you can't walk. The sports books are full as can be. Could there be other examples of people taking money? I mean, listen, the overs and unders, the props with Jonte Murray. I'm sorry, I keep saying Jonte. Jonte Porter. Yeah. Yeah, you can see that happening. That's why when this whole fantasy sports thing came up and commissioners all said, that's not gambling. I said, well, you know, can't people get to someone to have less yards or less catches? Now, those aren't prop bets, but it's the same idea in fantasy. So again, we've opened this can of worms in sports with gambling. I don't think we're going back. Now it becomes, how do you handle the guardrails where this Ohtani thing, where this Porter thing never surfaces and you get to it? Now the flagging, that's great. But there are going to be situations that we know are happening. And it just brings up this whole idea of integrity and propriety, you know, with officials and with officials and wearing jersey. And, you know, it's just this whole conversation we never had before. Listen, I don't want to sound like a fuddy-duddy, but I'm not into it. And I meet so many people, especially young people, that their interest in sports is dictated from gambling. Different kinds of sports fans. Now we can say that's okay, fine. But the world has changed. I understand it. Young people want to get them engaged. You know, gambling is an incredible fan engagement tool. Incredible. Everyone learned that from fantasy. So now it's even greater. And a great fan engagement tool, especially for a younger audience, which is what every league is trying to get. But there are consequences, some unintended, and that's going to continue. Okay. Let's move to the NFL. They had their meetings this week, annual owners meetings happening at posh resorts every year. This year it was Ritz-Carlton in Orlando. Sometimes it's the Biltmore in Arizona. Sometimes it's the Breakers in Palm Beach. One year I was in Hawaii, in Maui, we had the meetings. And the meetings are, you know, there's owners meetings, there's coaches meetings, and for people like me, the WCEs, we're the working club executives. And our meetings, we heard from the competition committee, they kind of practiced on us before they went into the owners. And then it's just it's a social event. You see owners hobnob together, you see families, wives, kids. It's a fun event. Now, the thing about the owners' meetings that I saw in those meetings was interesting because you would have these sessions where I was privy to sit in and you'd see some of the big market owners and small market owners go at each other. I remember Jerry Jones, who was always frustrated with smaller market teams that didn't market their brand like he did. A team like the Bengals especially went after Mike Brown, or at that time Wayne Weaver, owner of Jacksonville, or the Ursays in Indianapolis. They were made for some good theater. Now, what's coming out of this meeting? A couple things. A change kickoff rule. Let's thank the XFL for that. The NFL is trying to get the kickoff return back into play, which they've taken out of play for reasons of health and safety. But they think they can now combine the concerns of health and safety with bringing back the kickoff return, which is exciting play. I don't know the exact location of the players. I know there are no surprise onside kicks. That has to be announced. That's not a big deal. There were only two last year. I know that the kickoff in the end zone will now go from the 25-yard line to the 30-yard line. Remember, it went from the 20 to 25, now to the 30. Well, that will increase the kickoff team to not kick a touchback, to try to keep it in front of the 30-yard line. Again, I thought teams were incentivized last year to let the ball go into the end zone, and now they'll be further incentivized. So that means teams will kick off, hopefully for them, into the 5 to 1 yard line. We'll see what happens. I mean, again, bringing that back into play makes for some excitement, and they are pushing the return coverage team up in a not running start, standing start, to try to lessen all those impacts. So we'll see how that goes. Again, safety a concern, but also non-safety in trying to bring that back. In terms of safety, the big news out of this meeting is they've eliminated the hip drop swivel tackle. Now, just me saying that means that we're going to have a lot of discussion in game about whether a tackle should be penalized 15 yards and potential fines for the player for taking the player down by the side and doing the swivel. Again, now we're going to have officials debating and announcers, was it a swivel? Was it a true hip drop? Did it come from the side? Did it come from the back? Was it more of a butt bring down than a hip bring down? All these things are going to be in play. Okay, all about safety. We hear the NFL say we can never make it a completely safe game. We're going to try to make it safer. This is one of their initiatives to make it safer. On the player side, the NFLPA is against this because it discriminates against defensive players who are already having enough time figuring out where they can tackle. They can't tackle low to the knees. They can't tackle high to the head. There's a hitting zone. The bottom line, though, is that the business of football is at stake here. Offense sells. Offense is having scoring problems. Not big, but the NFL wants scoring to be about 45 plus per game. Last year, it averaged about 43. Get that up is have more penalized penalties for this kind of tackle. We'll see what happens. There's all kinds of Twitter from defensive players saying, what do we do? How do we tackle? Yes, we are making it harder on defensive players. There's no doubt about that. That is clearly happening, and it's a frustrating thing for defensive players. But offense sells, quarterbacks sell, running backs and receivers sell. The way they can move past this kind of tackle will only help offense, and offense will go up, hopefully over the 45 points a game. And everyone from the NFL business side will be happy. Again, for people who don't think the business of the NFL matters, here's another example. Speaking of which, I want to comment on a couple trades because free agency was fast and furious looking back now. Legarius Sneed got traded from the Chiefs to the Titans. Brian Burns got traded from the Panthers to the Giants. Now, these are two premium top of position players at premium positions. A shutdown cornerback and an edge rusher at the top of their game. And they got top of market contracts. But that's my point. In trading Sneed, the Chiefs only got a third round pick in 2025, which is like a fourth round pick in 2024. The Giants gave up a second and a fifth for Brian Burns. That's not adequate value. But here's the issue. It's economics. People don't understand how much finance matters in these trades. So the economics of the Titans having to pay Sneed $70-something million and the economics of the Panthers having to pay Burns $100 million matters. If those were rookie contract players, they would garner much more in a trade than what they did. So when you look at trade compensation, understand that money matters. And when Sneed's only drawn a third in 2025 and Burns is only drawn a second and fifth, that's because of those contracts that are part of that trade as well. If those players were making $5 million or were on rookie contracts, they would easily garner first round picks because that's the value. So you have to look at all those kind of things with value. I just wanted to talk about that. And speaking of trades, another thing coming out of the meetings, the trade deadline pushed back 1 week. So it goes from week 8 to after week 9. It used to be after week 6. That was way too early. I've talked about this before. When I was at Green Bay, Ron Wolf and I put forth these ideas for a late trade deadline, like baseball, like basketball. The league didn't want to be baseball and basketball where you could rent a player for a stretch run. They just really felt like that's not what we are. So this is a move in itself, moving it back a week. Again, the league doesn't want sellers. They don't want teams given up. But you're naturally going to have that win the trade deadline at any point. So we'll see how it goes. Moving it back from week 8 to week 9, a little more activity. That's what we really want. When we talk about the business of the NFL, let's get some buzz. That's what I would say to them is like, I understand your feelings about it, can't rent a player, but come on, it's about buzz. Okay. Speaking of buzz, the last thing I want to talk about, March Madness, we're in it now. We're in the heat of it. I watched Caitlin Clark last night. She's a force. I just thought it was an interesting story. I don't know if I hit on it last week. Fox. Okay, so Fox was trying to keep her in college, right? Trying to keep her at Iowa. And there was cockamamie stories that she'd make more being at Iowa than being in the NBA. Of course, her endorsements are going to come with her to the NBA. But I get it. I get it, Fox. Fox lost her. It's over. Fox has her in season, part of their Big Ten deal. But now the tournament's ESPN. And WNBA is ESPN. So Fox is never going to see her again. So the idea that Fox was trying to keep her in college, of course. Now, what did they offer? Who knows? Was it a big deal? Could they even do that? Could they make an NIL deal with Fox? Probably. But I just think this whole idea of Caitlin Clark playing in school, let's take the economics out of it. Doesn't she want to play against the best players in the world? And they're not in the Big Ten. They're in a WNBA. So I get it. But Fox trying to keep her, I get it totally, because they're done with her. She's done with Fox. Regular season's over. She's on ESPN in the tournament and ESPN on WNBA. And she is a force. I turned on Iowa basketball last night. And I had more appointment viewing for that than I don't think I did for any in men's game. We'll see. That may change as we get to the Sweet 16, Elite Eight, and Final Four. But they were on the ropes last night, Iowa. West Virginia really had them on the ropes, but they won. Okay. Got it in. All right. We covered everything. I went from baseball to basketball to the NFL to college basketball. But economics and business tied in throughout. Listen, if you like this, follow my reels at Instagram, Andrew Brandt 2. Of course, the Sunday 7 combined with daily videos. Have a new Lowe's subscription model. Go to andrew-brandt.com. Twitter, Andrew Brandt. Give us a rating. Share any thoughts with me. Send them to andrew@andrew-brandt.com. If you want to support the podcast, andrew-brandt-20. And of course, leave us ratings, reviews. Always like hearing from that on Apple Podcasts, wherever you hear your podcasts. Thanks to my producer, Jack Connell, my musical producer, Sam Brandt. Thanks to you for listening. And I'll be back next week with another edition of The Business of Sports with Andrew Brandt.